You're listening to the free abridged edition of the Energy Transition Show.
Oil, coal, hydro, nuclear energy, natural gas,
energy infrastructure,
solar power,
wind turbines.
There is this general global shortage in energy, and it's particularly acute in China, which is the world's biggest coal consumer.
The real world looks very different from the world in most of the IMs.
For September 28th, 2022, this is the Energy Transition Show with Chris Nelder. Incredibly, this is our 7th anniversary show. I know I say this every year, but I am amazed as ever that we've come this far and that our show's audience continues to grow. We have never spent a dime on advertising, never had a sponsor or advertiser, and grew our audience organically, one subscriber at a time, starting from zero, without a parent company to provide support. The success of our show is 100% due to word-of-mouth evangelizing by our listeners, and for that, we are deeply grateful. To all of our loyal subscribers who have sustained us and spread the word about our show, thank you all from the bottom of our hearts. As is our tradition, we like to use our anniversary shows to look back over the year that was and review some of the big stories we covered, as well as to try to take stock of how the energy transition has evolved and changed over the past year. And as always, our friend, energy researcher Jonathan Kumi, has graciously returned to the show to talk it all over with me and offer his own unique perspective on everything. Today we talk about how the global energy crunch we covered a year ago in episode 158 has now evolved into a full-fledged global energy crisis. We'll reflect on the theme of episode 181, Command Capitalism, and consider the increasing interventions that governments are making in energy markets. We'll muse on the episodes we did over the past year on the trajectory and the speed of the energy transition. We'll consider the outlook for storage systems in light of the episodes we did on that subject. We'll discuss how incumbents have resisted the energy transition, as we covered in our episode on utility corruption, and ask whether incumbents are gaining or losing ground. We'll review the highlights of our shows on the latest IPCC report and on climate modeling, and John will share some of his latest work in energy modeling. Then in the news segment, we'll take a quick look at the Inflation Reduction Act and CHIPS Act. We'll record a milestone in electricity transmission expansion in the Midwestern U.S. We'll note a number of advances in offshore wind in Europe. We'll check out the largest solar farm in snowy Alaska. And we'll recognize a bold new ban on internal combustion engine vehicles. But before we go to the interview,
announcements.
We want to remind our annual listeners that there are two ways you can share the Energy Transition Show with a friend or colleague. First, every annual subscriber has 3 share links per year that they can give to someone else. Each share link will give the recipient 1 free month of access to the show, which will let them listen to the 2 most recent full episodes. And second, there is a simple form on our website that you can use to give a year's subscription to a friend. To access both of these new features, just log into our website, click on your name in the upper right-hand corner, and go to the Manage Subscription page, where you'll find the Gift Accounts button. And if you're an annual subscriber, don't forget to post any open jobs you are trying to fill or look at the current openings on our exclusive members-only job board. As I record this, there are openings for business analysts, postdocs in energy economics, energy analysts, client managers, energy equity researchers, and more. So if you're looking for a new role, look no further than our job board, then join the legions of people working on the energy transition today. Finally, we'd like to extend a belated but warm welcome to some of our latest group subscribers. Andafina is a specialist advisory firm based in Australia, offering sustainability and resiliency consulting. Stockland Corporation Limited is a diversified Australian property development company. And Stonepeak Infrastructure Partners is a private equity firm investing in energy, transportation, water, and communication sectors in North America. Welcome all. We're so pleased to have you on board. And now, our anniversary roundup with Jonathan Kumi, recorded August 1st, 2022. So let's bring him back into the conversation now. Welcome back, John, to the Energy Transition Show.
Thanks, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
You know, I always look forward to these anniversary shows because it gives me a chance to take stock of what we covered over the past year and sort of take a step back and get a little perspective on the trajectory of the transition and of our show. And since you, like me, pay attention to a wide range of issues in the energy transition, I always like to get your take on the major questions that we've tackled over the past year. And I always find it interesting to see what you've been up to as well, because you always have interesting projects afoot. So we'll discuss some of those today too. So just to get us started here, I think I want to talk about what I've been calling the global energy crunch. This has been a much bigger story this year than I expected it would be a year ago when we first covered it in episode 158. Now, that was before Biden had authorized SPR releases to help consumers afford, gasp, $3 a gallon gasoline. And that was nearly 6 months before the Russian invasion. At the time, the proximate concerns were rising natural gas prices in the UK, which then gradually expanded to sort of a rising demand in prices for LNG in Asia and Europe, and then to rising prices in the US and the rest of the world. So it was really mostly a natural gas story, and then it spread to coal as soaring gas prices led some countries to fall back on their coal plants for power generation, which in turn pushed up coal prices to the point of unaffordability, forcing some power plants into outages. And then it started exacerbating various supply chain issues all around the world. So now we are in a situation where more than a few observers are seeing this macro picture emerging on this global energy crunch, particularly with respect to oil. Unstoppable demand growth in China, and then demand rebound in the rest of the world as it tries to get back to normal, even though the pandemic is anything but over, has collided with turmoil in major oil exporters like Nigeria, Iraq, and Angola, with weak investment in the U.S. oil patch and a limited appetite in the major OPEC producers for increasing production capacity, plus a general shunning of Russian oil by the West, which has materially reduced Russia's output as well. Now, I agree with a recent piece by Derek Brower in the FT in which he was getting those 2008 vibes all over again, and I linked to that in the show notes, but he wondered if there was another historic inflection point upon us, and I'm starting to feel that myself. What are your thoughts?
Well, the energy markets are like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's all connected, and so we're seeing that in the examples that you described. One of the things that's striking to me is that it's not just about crude oil prices. I think a lot of people think that the main driver, or perhaps the only driver, of gasoline price increases is the increased price of crude. And that's definitely a factor. But it's also true that gasoline prices are much higher than they have been in the past when crude oil prices were at their current levels. And so it's not just crude prices going up. It's also that there are refinery constraints. And if there's a different mix of products being demanded by consumers than refineries are set up to handle, you end up with these kind of constraints that can drive up prices for products in ways that are kind of separate from the increase in prices from the price of crude. So that's one of the high-level points that I'd like to make about it, is that you really do need to understand more than just the price of crude oil. It's not just about releasing crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's about what kind of crude is it, and what are refineries able to handle, and what are consumers demanding. And all those things are feeding into this increased price of petroleum products.
Yeah.
And the dynamics are a little different than just the straight crude oil price.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, so this distinction between crude oil and oil products also, it just points to the importance of understanding the complexity of the supply chain for oil and gas. What we've showed in several iterations of our oil climate index, and now we include gas in that, is that for emissions also, it's not just about price, but if for emissions also, how you find oil and gas, how you produce it, how you process it, and how you use it all have important effects on the total life cycle emissions. The old view was always to focus on products like gasoline and diesel and say, well, they're all more or less the same, and they are pretty comparable around the world. But when you focus instead on barrels of crude oil or cubic meters of gas, a different picture emerges. And that's because of all the complexity around carbon content of the oil, impurities in the oil, whether the oil field is old, so it has a lot of water mixed with the oil, whether there's leakage of natural gas, flaring of natural gas, and so on.
Yeah.
Another angle you didn't mention is this kind of lack of focus on energy efficiency as a response to deal with the energy crunch. And there's certainly been a lot of discussion about increasing production, but it's important to think also about ways to affect the demand of both crude oil as well as oil products. And I think that people have definitely been focused much more on the supply side. And I think that's a mistake, because there's plenty of ways to affect demand that will have perhaps an even more rapid effect on the price of oil. And that's something that we need to focus on in ways that we haven't thus far.
You know, I was going to just make the opposite point. I think it's actually in many ways faster to try to enact some sort of an increased supply than it is to cut demand, particularly for oil.
Well, I think that there are some things that take longer on the demand side, but there's a great report that the International Agency did, I think about 15 years ago now. It was called Saving Electricity in a Hurry. But the same sort of report could be focused on oil and gas. So there are things you can definitely do on the demand side that are quicker. And people in the electricity sector, they focused on shifting demand because of the real-time nature. But you can definitely imagine ramping up insulation programs. You can imagine ramping up programs to shift people to heat pumps and to heat pump water heaters. You can ramp up programs to get people to buy electric vehicles. And so I'm hopeful that this energy crunch, although it's been difficult and stressful in a lot of ways, will actually lead to a greater focus on these demand side interventions that will have a pretty big impact, at least in the medium term, on the demand for oil.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it's one of the things that we talked about in our episode on the Western response to the whole Russian situation in episode 171. And it was clear there that heat pumps are going to be a huge part of the response, especially with respect to finding ways to displace the need for Russian gas in Europe. But the oil thing is a lot harder to displace. All you have to do is look at a chart of U.S. oil consumption, or for that matter, gasoline consumption. And you can look back over the major crashes that we had in like 2008 and 2020, and you almost can't even see a detectable dip in demand in the U.S. It's remarkably resilient.
Well, but I think the shift after COVID was pretty noticeable because people were not commuting. And so I think that that's an example where the shift to telework actually was a pretty rapid response.
Yes.
To a different kind of crisis. But if you can implement that during a time like this energy crunch, then it could also have 5-6% sort of effect. And that could have a pretty big effect on prices.
That's right. So I think what we're seeing here is it's a very complex situation. You have the prices and they reflect kind of what they do. You have the emissions aspect of it, as you mentioned a moment ago. And then you have the time dimension of how quickly or how slowly you can respond to things in different ways. I think for the most part on the demand side, it takes a while. I mean, we've had a lot of discussion this past year about, for example, President Biden invoking the Defense Production Act to try to stimulate the production of heat pumps, because we just don't even have enough manufacturing of that, let alone training up more electricians to go out and install those things and just developing the literacy amongst contractors. I saw somebody post on Twitter today that when they talked to their local contractor a year ago about installing a heat pump, he recommended against it because he just didn't have the familiarity. And now that's his top recommendation. So it's taking a while to get people thinking about these new solutions, to get them comfortable, familiar with them, to get the manufacturing of this stuff out to consumers, and then just to get it installed. I mean, I don't know exactly how long it would take if you could get a contractor on the phone today to get a heat pump installed, but I'm guessing they couldn't do anything for you for months probably, because all the contractors around here anyway are just busy.
Yeah, and it turns out that we are actually in the process of getting bids on converting our furnaces to heat pumps.
Yeah.
We have two floors, one furnace on top, one furnace on bottom. And these are people who are recommended by some local energy efficiency folks. And we expect the bid actually this week. Mm. But what he said was that all of the supply chain is backed up.
Yeah.
And so for the really good technology, the more variable speed stuff, the stuff that's more advanced, it's taking 5-6 months.
Yeah.
And so we're lucky that we can do this on a somewhat leisurely schedule. Our furnaces are 25 years old, but there's nothing wrong with them. They'll last another season for sure.
Yeah.
So we can afford to wait. But for people whose furnace breaks in a cold climate, that could be a real big problem. And so I see that. That's hard.
Yeah, and supply chain problems have equally affected the supply of EVs.
Sure.
We've got all kinds of supply chain problems there, and that's another major way that we could attack the problem of oil supply from the demand side. But you can't do that quickly either if you can't get cars.
Yeah, and that's something we've learned. We've learned now, given this recent shock in the last few years, that lean supply chains, when they work well, are great at driving down costs, but they open you up to a lack of resilience.
Exactly.
It opens you up to different kinds of risks and different kinds of costs. And so I think there will be a shift away from this pure lean supply chain approach to having more diversified supply after this, because it's been such a disaster. I mean, just a massive, massive cluster.
Yeah. And you're reminding me now of how we got into this place. I guess we're both old enough to remember that the fascination with the lean supply chain kind of developed as a part of the Japanese management strategies back in the 80s, remember?
And yep, sure.
We're talking about how much smarter just-in-time supply is and how we're going to save everybody money and warehousing costs by eliminating all that stuff. But what you did in the process was you eliminated all the backup. You eliminated all the redundancy that gives you resiliency in those supply chains.
Right.
And I think what we're seeing now is we have to actually start rebuilding some of that buffer.
Yeah. And it also points to the fact one of the advantages of capitalism is that it's really good at driving down costs and eliminating redundancy and really getting things to be as efficient as possible given a certain set of external circumstances. But there are limits to what that can do, especially in a world that's changing rapidly, where there are other risks that having these lean supply chains, for example, open you up to.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think, an important lesson for people to realize, is that capitalism by itself does certain things very well, but it's not a cure-all. It's not by itself going to solve the problems that we have.
That's right. And the perspective of like, what's the fast way to respond to this stuff? I think there's a good reason why most people are looking to the supply side, because there's this expectation that certain oil producers, most particularly Saudi Arabia and UAE, have some spare capacity at hand where they can just sort of open up the taps and deliver another million barrels a day of oil, or maybe 1.5, to the global market. But in recent months, I think we've seen a number of indications that that may no longer be the case. And I honestly don't think the oil market has correctly priced in that risk at this point. I remember in the big oil crunch of 2008, where we saw prices, you know, shoot up to $147 a barrel, it was a combination of factors, as always, that led to that moment. There was definitely sort of a manic moment that was, price had gotten ahead of any kind of fundamental read on the situation. But an important part of that fundamental read was the lack of spare capacity. And when President Biden was in Saudi Arabia meeting with MBS a few weeks ago, he got the message that Saudi Arabia only planned to increase its production capacity by maybe another 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day. And once they got to about 13 million barrels a day, that would be it. And I think historically, they've only rarely exceeded 11 million barrels a day of production, and only for very short periods of time, I think maybe a few weeks. And so if, in fact, the global supply is reaching kind of its limit, if, in fact, spare capacity globally is at that sort of 1 to 1.5 million barrels a day, which is in a 100 million barrel a day system, more or less, it's about 1 to 1.5% marginal capacity still available, that's a problem, especially if we see Russian supply continuing to fall in response to Western sanctions and just sort of a lack of willing buyers. We could be in for a lot more trouble yet as far as oil is concerned. And that basically leaves you with nothing but relatively slow demand responses. So I think we could be in real trouble here in terms of oil supply, in terms of oil prices, but very closely associated with that is the natural gas supply and price story. I mean, we've seen just unbelievable power prices out of the UK and other parts of Europe, particularly France and Germany too. in the last couple of months. I mean, once these increased prices of power generation owing to higher natural gas prices make their way into retail bills, there is going to be some major consumer outrage and screaming. And I think we could see a situation here where a number of global governments are put in a position of just having to bail out consumers on their utility bills, whether it makes sense or not, whether it has anything to do with normal market functioning or not, just in order to maintain domestic tranquility.
So this is actually similar in some ways to the supply chain story, because natural gas used to be a local phenomenon. We had very low gas prices in the US for a long time, but as soon as we started building export terminals, and other countries did as well, suddenly we are opening up our gas markets to the vagaries in price of global markets. And as soon as there's a disruption like we've seen in the last year or so, you start to see where that kind of system leads to massive, massive shifts in prices and massive discontinuities. I think that's a real challenge, and that's something people need to think about. The problem ultimately is dependence on volatile fuels whose prices can change overnight.
Yeah.
And the medium to long-term solution is to replace fuels with capital, and with solar, with wind, with nuclear power, to the uses of fuels with more capital-intensive resources whose cost does not change based on what regime change in Saudi Arabia or the Russians invading Ukraine or anything else. The cost of wind, if you've built the plant, the cost is the cost.
Yeah.
And sure, there might be some O&M issues over time, but it's modest changes, right? It's not doubling the price overnight or more. So I think that's something that particularly politicians need to be thinking about, because the German story of shutting down nuclear power and not shutting down coal rapidly enough, this is the kind of short-term thinking that has gotten us into a lot of trouble. And we really need to be thinking about this longer term of, we just have to get off of these fuels as rapidly as we can.
Yeah, and frankly, I think quite a bit too much has been made of that particular issue, because all you got to do is look at France, which has continued to be committed to its nuclear power and to not try to shut them down. And they have more than half of their nuclear generation fleet offline for most of this year, and some of the highest power prices in Europe as a result, as they're pulling on imports from anywhere they can get it. So not shutting down nuclear plants has not been much of a help for France, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the context is different, but I feel like the aggressive ramping down of nuclear power in Germany was probably a mistake from a climate perspective. And keeping those around a little longer might be helpful in some ways. The French problems are a separate set of issues, because they have a very high dependency on nuclear. And they've had issues now with the rivers being too warm, and that makes it harder to run the plants. And there's been some mechanical issues as well.
Their biggest problem in France is that they haven't continued to reinvest in proper maintenance of that fleet. And so they've got a lot of old, decrepit plants that are just falling apart, in addition to sort of these weather-driven issues. But that's another matter. I think the overall takeaway is that we are not in the same position now globally as we were in the last big oil price spike of 2008, in the very way that you mentioned, that since then, much of the world has switched over their demand to natural gas. And everybody did that sort of at the same time. And so what we've done is we've made the whole world much more dependent on LNG than they were in 2008. And it's the shortage of that LNG capacity now as a way of replacing pipeline gas from Russia in specific that is really leading to some of these other effects of high grid power prices across Europe. And so again, I think we're looking at a situation here where global governments are going to have to respond. And that leads me to the next topic, I think, of command capitalism, which is what we talked about with Kevin Book of Clearview Energy Partners in episode 181, the episode right before this. With Kevin, we discussed how the world's governments are increasingly reaching out for direct interventions in their energy markets. And I guess we got to put quotes around markets now to try to avoid social unrest and economic destruction and what all that means for the transition. In that conversation, we went over a bunch of cases in point, the SPR releases we just talked about, but also Germany having to bail out Uniper because it was now upside down in its cash flow situation with high gas prices. France now actually fully nationalizing its utility, EDF, because it just cannot manage the expense of trying to keep its nuclear fleet running. Italy imposing gasoline price caps. In the UK, we have the regulator Ofgem having to move customers to new retail energy providers after their providers went belly up. And by the way, while all that's going on, the companies that went bust, their executives walked away with millions. So, and then we've seen a bunch of governments, the UK, South Africa, Pakistan, etc., saying that they're going to directly own and build new nuclear plants because the private sector wants none of it. And of course, here in California, we recently saw the passage of AB 205, which featured just an unprecedented level of intervention in just a whole slew of different ways in California energy markets. One has to look at all this and wonder if the state utility regulator here in California, the CPUC, or for that matter, any utility regulator anywhere, is really prepared to take on the challenges of the energy transition amid all of the market turmoil we've been seeing now, especially with the Russian invasion of Ukraine exacerbating everything, and let alone whether we can keep expecting to let markets and not direct interventions guide us through this future. So what are your thoughts on that question? Are we about to see the states, or maybe nation states, taking a more active hand in guiding their energy destinies and perhaps a diminished role for utility regulatory commissions or other energy regulators? We hope you've enjoyed this free sample of the Energy Transition Show. Our full episodes cover much more and are typically 60 to 90 minutes long. When you become a full annual subscriber, you'll get 2 new complete episodes each month, access to our entire back catalog, extensive show notes, interview transcripts, the text of the news items for each episode, and access to our exclusive job board. Your premium members-only subscription will work in all apps and players that support podcast feeds, including Apple Podcasts and Pocket Casts, so you can easily listen from your mobile device on the go. The first 33 episodes of the Energy Transition Show were free, and always will be, so if you want to see what our full shows contain, feel free to check those out. Then we hope you'll become a member and support our show. In order to bring you the most unfiltered, unbiased, honest information possible, we have elected not to take any sponsors or advertisers. The Energy Transition Show is entirely supported by listener subscriptions. To become a subscriber and enjoy our full offerings, just point your browser to energytransitionshow.com and click the Become a Member button. Annual subscriptions, which include full access to our entire back catalog of full-length episodes, are just $60 a year. Monthly subscriptions are $6.99 a month and give you access to the 2 most recent episodes. Single episodes can be purchased for $7 each. We also offer discounted annual subscriptions for individual university students and professors, as well as group licenses for companies, nonprofits, and universities. So join us today and support our ad-free podcast featuring high-quality, cutting-edge interviews and news about the most important story of our time, energy transition. And now a quick look at some recent news items. Item 1. By now, I assume you've all heard plenty about the $370 billion Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S., the largest climate bill in U.S. history. You may have even heard about some of the recently announced investments that will capitalize on incentives offered in that bill, and in other recent federal funding offers to accelerate the energy transition, like Arizona-based First Solar's decision to spend up to $1.2 billion to expand its solar panel production in the U.S., or an energy startup called Sparks that's building a battery factory in West Virginia that will produce cobalt-free batteries, or Toyota's announcement that it will invest an additional $2.5 billion in a U.S. facility where it manufactures vehicle batteries, or the announcements by Honda and Panasonic that they will each spend $4 billion in U.S.-based EV battery manufacturing plants. But there was another law passed 2 days later that could direct an estimated $67 billion towards zero-carbon industries and climate research in the U.S., the $280 billion CHIPS Act. If Congress appropriates the funding authorized in the act, it could, together with the Inflation Reduction Act and last year's infrastructure law, more than triple the federal government's average annual spending on climate and clean energy this decade as compared with the 2010s. The CHIPS Act will aim to help emissions reduction technologies get to commercial scale by increasing funding to the U.S. Department of Energy, including its national labs, as well as establishing new offices like a Directorate of Technology that will explicitly pursue industrial policy. And to all of the above, I say, it's about damn time. Item 2. In late July, MISO, one of the 9 structured wholesale power markets and transmission grids in the U.S., approved 18 new high-voltage transmission lines in what will be the single largest transmission expansion enabling clean energy. Well, that's it for this episode of the Energy Transition Show. Thanks for listening. You can find our show archive and give us feedback and suggestions at energytransitionshow.com and follow us on Twitter at Transition Show. Chris Nelder creates the show, Kevin Melsheimer edits it and makes us all sound brilliant, and Justin Ritchie produces our listener experience. Mike Sugar composed and produced our theme music, and you can find him at mikesugarmusic.com. The Energy Transition Show is a production of the XE Network.